A massive El Nino on the way, but what is an El Nino? What is a La Nina? Scott Stevens joins us in a moment. We'll talk about these unusual weather patterns and also some severe things that could be happening. We'll check in with Scott in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. George Norrie with you. Scott Stevens, our special guest now for the next couple hours. Scott is living an award-winning television weathercaster. He investigated the claims of Lieutenant Colonel Tom Bearden that the Soviets were engineering weather over North America, and that was around 1976. During the course of those investigations, he was the first to show weather patterns were anomalous to natural weather conditions, and he continues, of course, to talk about weather imagery to all kinds of people. Scott Stevens back on Coast to Coast. We've missed you, Scotty.
It's been every bit of 6 months, George, every bit of that length of time.
The only way to get you here, we're going to get you on the show, is just to beam you up, Scotty.
I'm right there. Simple. I'm right there. And everybody's earbuds or garages or cars or trucks as it is at this time of night.
Explain what a La Nina is, first of all.
Ooh. La Nina is when we have a cooling in the mid-Pacific Ocean. And it is in contrast to an El Nino, which is a warming. And so we have these regular oscillations that run 3 to 5 years, 3 to 5 years, that'll oscillate between a warm spell and a cool spell. So it happens when we have the trade winds coming off of Chile across the equatorial and just south of the equatorial Pacific, and these trade winds allow for an upwelling of cooler water. And then this cooler water does not evaporate as much, and it impacts the circulation then in the jet stream and the winds above it. And this is what we're really understanding, is that climate on this planet is a series of interrelated cycles. Some are much longer in cycle, like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is an oscillation of upwards of 30 to 60 years in time. And then you have the El Niños and La Niñas superimposed upon this larger oscillation. And so right now the North Pacific is exceedingly warm. I mean, far, far warmer. They've called it the warm blob off the coast of British Columbia into the Gulf of Alaska. It's just that warm, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 degrees above normal.
That's a lot.
Immense.
Yeah.
It's huge when you consider the capacity of water to hold heat as compared to air.
You know, whoop. You with us, Scotty? Wow. That's weird. Well, Gina, call him back. You've got his backup phone, and you've got the interview number, and we'll try to get you back. That has got to be the weirdest sound I've ever heard. I am now convinced, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that when they get into something controversial, because he was just about to, as we're going to talk about weather modification and things like that, they've got him. Now, we've got two potential phone numbers for him, right? Two numbers. Try his backup number, too. And just as soon as you get him, Gina, we'll put him on and do that, because I'm going to just do my little dance for a little bit until we get Scott Stevens back on, if we can. And Gina, do you have him? You do not. All right. Have you tried his backup phone? And you're not getting anything there yet? Wow. This is strange, folks. Strange. Well, Danny, I just might interview you for a little bit as we, if we do. I don't want to go to open lines. We've got open lines coming up on Friday with our great, but this is bizarre. I think we've got him now. All right, let's bring him back. Where did you go?
I heard a fax beep in on me is what it sounded like. It truly sounded like a fax line was trying to come in on this.
That's weird.
That's exactly what it sounded like.
They are out to get you, Scott, whenever you're talking about anything controversial.
You know, and are these cycles controversial? Or they're well known. They're understood. You know, they're in the scientific literature.
Well, we're going to talk about modification, too, and I bet they knew that.
We'll get there. We'll absolutely get there. You know,
that was
George, I posted a on my Facebook page back in July 23rd, about this particular El Nino. And we've talked about this California drought. When I was up there in Louisville with you January of last year, you know, this drought is unprecedented, at least in the human lifetime. You know, in the past 100 years, you know, there hasn't been one quite like it. And for the large and the majority of the West, for that matter, as well. You know, we have so many more people living out here than we ever used to. I mean, California's, what, bumping up on 40 million people, dependent on runoff, essentially. And now that dependency has gone to groundwater. So what I'm seeing with this El Nino is that this California drought ends, and it will end spectacularly. As the cold air, you know, from the winter comes across the Pacific, we end up with a trough well established into the Gulf of Alaska, and storm after storm impact that state.
Well, we're going to need that, and I hope your prediction is right, Scott, because we are so dry out here. Fires everywhere.
Well, it's painfully dry because, you know, even at our grocery store here, we can't get bok choy from California. The almonds have gone way up in price. It's impacting that state's ability to feed, and it largely feeds this country with so many fruits, nuts, vegetables that we don't get from anywhere else. The importance of that state's agricultural, you know, and it is agribusiness now rather than agriculture, is not well understood by the regular population.
No.
It just isn't.
Now, in the Atlantic, do they have anything like El Nino in the Atlantic, anything like that?
You know, the ocean isn't quite as large, and so they're not dealing with those same kind of oscillations that the Pacific does.
What side gets the most severe weather, the Pacific side or the Atlantic side?
When it comes to El Ninos?
When it comes to just severe weather, period.
I would have to say the Atlantic side, at least as far as the Americas are concerned.
With hurricanes, you mean?
With hurricanes, because of the easterly trades. You've got those strong easterly winds that Hawaii is definitely embedded in. You know, Puerto Rico, Cuba, the east winds that, you know, impact the Florida Peninsula and then on into Texas. And as those east winds have the entirety or the bulk of the Pacific to spin up, we see those typhoons regularly impacting China, Japan, Taiwan, you know, the Philippines and so forth. And so the Pacific is active in that way, whereas the Atlantic has not been. And that, again, is also, there is some correlation with the Pacific decadal oscillation to tropical storm formation in the Atlantic. And I think meteorology and climatology is still a maturing science. There are aspects of it that are, you know, just now being understood. And there's esoteric sciences when you begin to bring in, say, the Oregon concept that, you know, science is just oblivious to. And when we go through this coming century and science is kind of freed from the fetters of you know, if it can't be observable on the outside, well, then it simply doesn't exist. You know, there's going to be some great understandings and some immeasurable strides made in many of these sciences when they can evolve. And I have great hope that that will happen in my lifetime.
How long does an El Nino last? Just a season or more?
Not much more than 18 months.
Okay.
Not much more than 18 months. And this one is still in the process of building. And at its intensity now equals the one of 97-98.
Is it always El Nino, La Nina every other year, or could you have an El Nino for the first 10 seasons, let's say?
No, it has to oscillate. It has to oscillate. It's just like a pendulum. It must go back and forth.
Back and forth.
Now,
okay.
after the 97-98, El Nino, there was a pretty intense 20-month dry spell that came right after that. So it's like this winter is going to be a make-or-break one again. But I think there will be some engineering that will help it be wetter and more intense than it would be otherwise. Because that's what the geoengineers do. They take us from too hot to too cold, and then from too dry to too wet. And there's just this precious, precious little space in between where productivity can be maximized.
Do you think the California droughts have been caused by man?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And even if even if the overriding pattern is part of a natural cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take the example of what happened here in the San Luis Valley in the last 14 days.
Oh, 14 days.
Monsoonal
okay.
The monsoonal moisture has been streaming in and is still overhead today with Hurricane Linda off the coast of the Baja. That high level, that tropical moisture is still pouring into the southwest. Yet the number of thunderstorms capable of producing rains was far, far underneath what climatology or what should be there. And I can go out there and you can see the storms. There'll be pulses that will show up in the time-lapse imagery, literally waves that will come across and wreck the mid-level part of these storms, meaning above about 18,000 feet, just completely render them helpless in their ability to produce rain. The key, well, there's two signatures that you look for that. Number one is a profound appearance of mammatus clouds, turbulence. And the visual that you can go to YouTube and look for that is, look, Google, or look for underwater waves. So you'll take surfers that will go around, take their GoPro cameras, and then shoot how waves, ocean waves, break above them. And you'll see how that turbulence in the top of those ocean waves looks exactly like these thunderstorms that are being disrupted. And so here in this valley, where we should have had every bit of 2 to 3 inches worth of rain, and this is the end of the monsoon season. We're going to go into two typically dry months now. This is when the trees finish. This is when the crops finish. And these last rains were stolen from us. And it was day after day after day in the time lapse. You can see the planes come out. The lines in the sky go where they introduce the waves, then they measure their intensity, and then tear the thunderstorms from the top down. And that's exactly what they can do and have been doing in California. And the same thing, they can accentuate that storm development in Texas. I mean, Texas had endured a 4-year drought. And so
and then bang, right?
And parts of Kansas, and in 6 weeks it was gone. 6 weeks. They had their wettest May in Oklahoma in 121 years, the length of record, 121 years. So it can be done. It can be done. And if people just, I don't know. I think at this point it's just a function of awareness. With awareness, then things can change. But I think it's going to take an external force to break the ties from us to the powers that be.
Scott, how do you manipulate weather? How do you do it? Do you do it from HAARP?
Tools.
Where do you do it?
I think you can use HAARP. I think that's a way to introduce pulses into the atmosphere, like a drop in the water and the waves go out. But I also believe that we're using waves. There are probably infrasound waves, very, very long frequency waves, and you can see them undulating across and creating essentially two tsunami-like cloud forms. You'll see cumulus with little crests on them. And you can see, I mean, if people could spend $300 on a GoPro camera and set it up in your house, you would utterly be blown away by the waveforms that manufacture these weather storms. So waves are a big one in that. And how those are introduced and then constrained is a big part of it. I think another incredibly powerful tool is the orgone of Wilhelm Reich's discovery. That is the water attractant. That is the crown jewel. And when you can manipulate that, and I think that is a big reason why we see hundreds and hundreds of planes flying low and slow through the atmosphere. That was his preferred way to do it. It was get up into a plane, you know, and it's simple, gentle ionization of the atmosphere. You play with the ionization, and this biosphere, this planet's atmosphere, is so finely tuned that 1-3% in one direction creates rain, 1-3% in the other direction creates drought. And if you've got a mobile Air Force up there disguised in United and Southwest and Ryanair and British Airways and Lufthansa and, you know, all of these airplanes, you know, most of what I see here in the valley, in the San Luis Valley, are aircraft on a mission. They're probably drones. And they just crisscross the sky, just shaping the atmosphere how do I want to say this? If you were to take a bucket of water, dump it onto cement. It's going to splash out in a uniform spread pattern. Now, if we were to add sound, speakers, and turn up the volume, you could actually direct the water to where you want it to flow. Change the tone, change the frequency, change the angle of the speakers, and you could redirect how that water hits and flows along that level cement. And that's what they're doing with these aircraft in the skies. And this is why they need those trails. So that this sound, these waves, have some grip, hold of the water molecule. Almost every single water molecule is contaminated by some condensation nuclei that they have put in the sky. And this nuclei can be pulsed like magnetic filings and a magnet. You turn the magnet and the filings are going to respond. They're going to either jump, go flat, or they're going to respond in some way to that impulse. So that's why they need this atmosphere, highly conductive, highly conductive. The other downside of that for us in the West, because it's been so dry, is that it's very easy to get low precipitation thunderstorms, meaning you get high base thunderstorms, but yet you get a lot of lightning. And so that triggers fires.
Just in Utah last week, some individual, a teacher, she was a softball coach, got hit by lightning, gone. I mean, what a horrible way to die. Jeez.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, and it's been close. I've had close calls, too. And
are you a weather chaser?
I used to be. I have a healthy respect for it. And I don't need that adrenaline rush at this point in my life. I've chased tornadoes, and we've got a paper written about electromagnetic fields recorded inside thunderstorms, especially the rotating ones. And that was sufficient. That was sufficient. And kudos to those guys that get out and do it. And the photography that some of them come back with is just, it's inspiring. It's inspiring. The beauty of these storms, even though, you know, I know they're tweaked. These thunderstorms are tweaked. They're kind of showing their internal guts and revealing, you know, they're not bubbling clouds like we were taught in school, where it's just the heat rising and, you know, bubbles and condenses and there's lift and blah, 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 blah. There's a rotating aspect to these storms. And everything in nature that rotates is going to torque the field, going to torque the magnetic field. And when all of the water droplets are doped up with these metals, something rotating is going to create an electrical field. And this charge is going to draw water to it in incredible quantities with the greater the torsion, the spin. And so we're seeing these columns, cylindrical columns, and clouds, and this spectacular supercell photography that we're seeing today is unmatched when you look back through history. Yes, there were some beautiful examples before, but what we see today is unlike the photography of the 1950s or the 1930s. And granted, the number of pictures now to then, there's no comparison, but yet the storms are structurally different.
And they're more intense, Scott.
Agreed. And one of the things they can do is tilt the storm on its side. When a storm has to go straight up, it'll run out of buoyancy once you get beyond a certain level. It'll go into negative cape or convective available potential energy, and it'll begin to peter out, and then you get the anvil head. These storms are tipped over. And as you know, when you deal with geometry, when you have a triangle and you begin to tip one of the sides from vertical to say, a 45-degree angle, you get a much longer tube before you reach that point, say 55,000 feet in the atmosphere, where you run out of buoyancy, or even 45,000 feet. So you can have a storm that is 10 miles long in diagonal length versus maybe 6.5 or 7 miles in height when it develops vertically.
Let's talk more about the weather, Scott, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take calls next hour with Scott Stevens as we talk about the weather. Scott, you loved the weather since you were a kid, didn't you?
I did, George. I did. I must admit.
I bet whenever it stormed.
playing in the rains after the thunderstorms, but making little aircraft carriers and battleships and playing Army. that was me.
I love it. Let's talk about some strange anomalies. We were talking about the intensity of these storms these times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I go back to St. Louis, we get hit with some pretty severe weather. Lots of rain, tornadoes, and it's just severe stuff, more than I can remember. What's happening? Has the modification gone crazy?
Has it gone crazy, or is it just right? You know, there are strange things happening, George. It's like there has to be, let's just say it's a sum-zero game. Yeah, unit one of rain has to come out of the weather, out of the, you know, whether it's planetary or nationwide, one bit of rain has to come out. And if they stop it here, stop it here, stop it here, stop it here, and let it come out just here, here, and here, then what's going to manifest is going to be more intense. Because the rain allows a circuit to be completed for the atmosphere to do what it needs to do. Either it's to cry, or in the terms of Wilhelm Reich, the rain was the orgasm, the release, the venting of energy from the atmosphere. And if that is stopped and stopped and stopped and stopped, just like a kid, you're gonna get frustrated, and you're gonna want to act out. And so I think they've played with the weather so long that it can get out of control very quickly.
And they can't control it anymore, can they?
Well, that, or they have to bring in bigger guns. They have to hit it with another technology to knock it back. Or just back off and say, act of God.
Is it smart to have this technology for warfare?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think it's smart to have the technology worked out and understood. George, who's to say that some aspect and understanding of it isn't ancient? You know, I'm not uncomfortable going there to saying that there isn't stuff left over from previous civilizations that maybe they figured out how to play with as well. And maybe what that technology is better than the stuff that, you know, either Tesla worked out or Wilhelm Reich worked out, or they were playing with it with World War II. You know, there's a lot of things that I'm just kind of guessing at, but they're on the table. And who's to say which general at what time doesn't say we need this tool deployed in this theater of operation? We've got this tool, this tool, this tool, and this tool, and who is using what and when? And that's the kind of looking at the sky and trying to figure out, you know, what's happening from the weatherman's perspective, you know, who's, you know, just gone to classical school rather than to, you know, the one for the Air Force or the one for Naval Intelligence or the one for the Area 51 guys or for the ones that play with UFOs. You know, they all have their different understandings of how the atmosphere responds to energy, whether it's, you know, RF energy, whether it's ionization, whether it's, you know, who knows? When you spend probably trillions of dollars at it, you know, they're gonna have results. After World War II, owning the weather was high on their list of things that they wanted to do. And there was a lot of money thrown around in the 50s so they could begin to experiment. And what we're seeing today is a result of those projects that are 60, 70 years old. They've been with us all of our lives. We know nothing different. At least you and I, there's probably older folk out there listening, but I have grown up and operated professionally entirely under this regime, unknowingly, most of it. And I think it'll change. I know it'll change, George. There are things coming, because every effect that's put out in this universe or in this creation has an ensuing effect. You put out a cause, an effect is going to come back at you. And they have done this for so long. And whether it's an effect from us or an effect from a higher authority, and I believe that's what's going to step in and stop this. I mean, cut the cord, cut the ties that bind us to these people. You know, they're building their underground bases for a reason. There's a lot of talk about why they would want to build their underground bases. And there's something out there that they're going to try and hide from.
Yeah, there's something they know that they don't think we do.
Right, right.
But we do know.
And, well, we know something. What we don't know are dates and the events. And you talk to a lot of people from all different walks of life. And so, you know, your listeners have probably been exposed to, you know, the whole agenda of what potentially is out there. I just have a feeling something's coming from outside this planet.
No, you might be right.
That's just what I think. And what I've gotten, you know, in my own inner consciousness and with connections, that it's going to be big and there's going to be a lot of them. I've never, ever had UFO dreams, George, and I'm having them now.
What's happening to you, Scotty?
I just last, well, it was 2 weeks ago, I got cubes.
Are they
cubes in the sky?
Are they beaming things at you?
No, George. No, they were like big cubes, truly like Borg cubes. There were two of them. And then with this rocky moon in front of them, they could change rotation. It could move in one direction, and then it was a conscious entity. But what was so freaky is as I was looking through it in this dream, I was looking at it through my cameras.
In a dream.
And I could, in a dream. And there was all kinds of Egyptian hieroglyphics in bands around the top of these cubes.
Hmm.
And I had this understanding that there were very evolved people, largely of benevolent intent, and spiritually very mature.
Now you say largely of benevolent intent. That doesn't sound like 100% to me.
Well, we still live in duality. And so as long as we're dealing with more than one person, then there are going to be other agendas at play. So if you have, you could look at the human race. There's some beautiful people.
Scotty, can't say that.
Okay, there's some real, you know, people that need to grow up. There really are.
Yeah, sure is.
And so I think that race or that energy, that message I got from them is that they were far, far more evolved. They had our better intent. They wanted that for us. They absolutely wanted that for us. So, I was okay with seeing it. But and then the other one, George, was an eclipse. This happened back on March 11th. There was an eclipse, and I was pointing out to people around me that, we've got an eclipse, and it's the middle of the day, and there's something blocking the sun, and it should not be there.
Uh-huh.
It should not be there. Whatever there is very, very big, and it should not be blocking the sun. And I've never had UFO dreams before.
Hmm.
So
something's happening.
Either they're coming into the consciousness, you know, on a grand scale, I think that's about the only solution I can come up with. But something's coming, and I'm curious to see what it is. The other is that my partner, who is always having, you know, he saw Fukushima before it happened. He saw the Banda Aceh earthquake before it happened. There was a series of literally hundreds, if not thousands, of, he couldn't tell whether it was explosions or hits from space, primarily focused on Eastern Asia and the Western Pacific. But then as the planet rotated towards Africa, towards Europe, towards the Atlantic, and then eventually the Americas, they tapered off. The numbers weren't as great, but they were still present. And again, no dates, just the event. And so, you know, I grew up in a Mormon family, and it was all about food storage. It was all about preparation for who knows what.
Oh, and you have to be ready. It could come tomorrow. It could come 100 years from now. Who knows? But
yeah, it could. And then it like your ad before they came on, you know, $99 worth a month worth of food. That's, don't eat it, save it.
You got to. Have you looked at Yellowstone and the possibility of that caldera blowing up?
You know, if we were to take strikes from space, George, there would be all kind of undulations that would ripple across the crust of this planet. And so many of those weaker places could go, whether it's in a full-on eruption or they're just broken to the point where they vent. It doesn't matter. There would be enough particulates, changes in the chemistry of the atmosphere, water vapor vaulted into the sky, that we would see a climatic change. Full stop. That's what would happen.
I mean, if that caldera goes, Scott, we're toast.
Yeah, it does. It does. And then we all get to leave the planet, it gets to heal itself, and we go on our merry way.
And it starts again, you know, and again.
And this cycle goes on. You know, we're down here, and the journey down here is a very long one. It's a very, very long one.
How many times do you think mankind might have been obliterated from some Earth catastrophe and then started all over again?
Five times.
Over a course of how many millions of years?
You know, if you get into the guy's book, and I'm not remembering his name right off the top of my head, Forbidden Archaeology.
Michael Cremer.
That's it. Yeah. That's it. And, you know, there are human footprints in sand or on the beach, and there are large reptilian footprints or dinosaur footprints right there. And, you know, so at least over 300 million years, either we've been visitors, have explored, or have been residents of this planet. And when we go through grand cycles, you know, of over millions of years with golden ages where we're highly enlightened and are very, very aware of the planet, you know, it's spirituality, it's benevolence. And then we go through, you know, Kali Yugas or Iron Ages like we're in now, where we are entirely disrespectful, we're greedy, we're selfish, we're arrogant, we're childlike, and then we go back again. Time, we're just back and forth, we're running these cycles. And so humankind may have been here, but, you know, how many times has your soul incarnated on this planet? And for me, it's probably, you know, just
countless.
You know, just this last cycle, so we can finish this thing out.
Are you a believer in, like, you know, prophecy, Book of Revelation, end times? Do you go there?
I think there's value in it. I think over the 2,000 years since it's been written, it has been altered to the point where so much of it can be taken out of context and misinterpreted. This cycle ends, and we have probably two to three decades, and we'll see. Jeez. You know, if the planet does truly start to spin the other direction, you know, the pyramids were pointed and we rotated to the east, and then the magnetic field will flip and we'll rotate to the west.
See, I'm convinced, Scott,
we'll rotate to the east,
that the planet's alive. Let me tell you why. I mean, we need rain to survive, or everything dies. The trees die, the bushes die, the grass dries. We need rain for that.
That's a must.
The planet is designed generally to do that. And to me, there's something behind that.
Agreed.
I mean, it is truly a remarkable device that keeps this engine called Earth moving ahead.
It's a living organism. It's an absolutely living organism. You know, with there's a guy that you should really have on this show. It would be an enlightening interview, and his name is J.J. Dewey. Are you familiar with him?
J.J. Dewey? No.
J.J. Dewey. He wrote the book first called The Immortal, and he's got a series of books out there, and he's had some experiences. You know, he's into knowledge rather than I mean, I understand the reach of his information, but it is very, very enlightening. And there's two entities that shepherd this planet. One of them is a race of people, and there are seven of them. And in his work, they're called the divine hermaphrodites. And they have the single eye, that light that's on our money. They are the balanced perfection of the physical manifestation of the humanoid form. And they live in the physical when they need to, but largely in the more etheric realms. And there are seven of them that shepherd this planet. Because the physical organism of this planet is still very, very young. In his work, he equates it to the intelligence and awareness of, say, a 3 or 4 year old human being. And so we're not a spiritually, or this planet hasn't been and granted, you know, a spiritual protection yet. It's kind of barren out in the open, but very, very youthful. And like a toddler or a kid is terrible twos and threes, you know, this planet is young and it's very, very vibrant. And it just hasn't quite matured yet. And in his work, because we're in the universe of seven, seven tones, seven colors, seven rays, everything is in a base of seven. This solar system is shepherded by a sun, and it also has a solar logos. And then this planetary has a planetary logos. It was the god that that Moses saw, and Joseph, and the coat of many colors, and that was these particular beings that are looking over this planet, watching out for it, and protecting it. And when they come and want their due and want to manifest prophecy that has been given the Old Testament, guys, it'll be these people that do it. It will be this intelligence that watches over it. And J.J. Dewey would be a very good interview for him.
The closest I've ever got, we had a guy named Steve Dewey, but never a J.J., so I'll check into him.
Yeah, J.J., John Joseph. It's funny because I had two people who were intuitively said, you've got to read this book. It's a red book, gold lettering. You need to read it. And that happened over the course of 2011 and 2012. Not random people. Obviously, nothing's random in this universe. But over that course of time, said, you need to get this book. And so I read it, and it answered a lot of questions about how this planet is run and how the lower creations, the lower dual worlds work. You know, karma is a big part of it, cause and effect. There is a scroll, and each one of us has a scroll. Every thought, emotion, and eventually action is recorded without fail. Without fail. It's all registered.
All right, Scotty, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break, and we're going to come right back. And what I'd like you to do, you might have questions for Scott Stevens, but I want you to share an incredible weather story with us. Where have you been? Have you been in a tornado, severe storms, basement flooding, 5 feet? Share something with us like that when we come back.